Thursday afternoon, and you're listening to KRCL, your community radio station. This is The Nature of Things, brought to you by the Utah Museum of Natural History, located at 1390 East President Circle at the University of Utah. The Nature of Things is a weekly show that brings you topics of interest in science and the natural world. Good afternoon and welcome to The Nature of Things, underwritten by Bank One. I'm your host, Lisa Hurl, and today we'll be discussing the Utah Museum of Natural History's new temporary exhibition, Art and the Animal, which opened on February 8th and will run until April the 6th. Art and the Animal is a show displaying paintings and sculpture that explore the human relationship with animals and nature. We are very pleased to have animal artist Carl Bress Van Kampen with us today, and curator and art historian Dr. David Wagner, who joins us by phone from Bailey's Harbor in Wisconsin. Welcome to both of you.
Hi. Good morning.
All right, David, let's start with you. I understand that Art and the Animal was presented by the Society of Animal Artists. Now, could you tell us a little bit about who they are and how they got started as a group?
You bet. The Society of Animal Artists is a worldwide organization based in New York City on Fifth Avenue, not far from another campus, the campus of New York University. And the society is comprised of about 350 members from all continents and all corners of the world. It is very difficult as an artist's organization to get into, as Carl, who's with us, can, I'm sure, attest to. Many artists try and try to become members of the Society of Animal Artists by submitting their work in a portfolio for jury by peers, and the society hosts an, I think, biannual membership jury, one in the fall and one in the spring, to consider applications from artists throughout the world. But since it is a jury by peers, and by that I mean fellow artists, artists who are members of the society, they really bring a critical eye to the assessment of the work being submitted for consideration with people who aspire to become members. And once they become a member through that difficult process, all sorts of wonderful benefits accrue to members of the Society of Animal Artists. One of the greatest benefits, I think, though Carl may differ, but it certainly must be the ability to submit your work yet again for another judging. I guess you have to be thick-skinned as an artist to take all of this judging and critiquing and so forth, but submitted yet again by another peer panel review committee each spring for consideration for display in the annual Society of Animal Artists exhibition. And that exhibition, Lisa, premieres at different locations around the nation, and it's from that then that about 50 paintings and 20 sculptures are selected for national tour. And that kind of exposure, the kind of exposure we provide the artists, such as they're getting now at your wonderful museum on campus at U of U in Salt Lake, really affords artists great visibility, a lot of connections to collectors, to admirers of their work, and just the camaraderie and connections that develop from participating in this kind of world-class artist membership organization.
Well, and it's a beautiful show, if I do say so myself.
Thank you.
Now, it seems to me that wildlife art in particular, I mean, it seems very accessible to the public, possibly a lot more accessible than a lot of other art forms. It's like the viewer has an immediate recognition and often a kind of emotional response to a lot of the pieces. Could maybe you and Carl both talk to that a little bit?
Well, I could say that you can be fooled by thinking that the work contained in Art and the Animal or representational animal art, which mostly, I suppose, is wildlife, is simple and immediately accessible. And on one level, I think it is, Lisa.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this kind of art, generally because it, like a photograph, portrays imagery that the eye, that people with their eyes can read and understand. Is this a deer? Is this a duck? Is this an animal? Is this a landscape or whatever? But on the other hand, I found artists like Carl Bress Van Kampen and sculptors like Kent Ulberg to be not merely painting on the surface, but really digging deeply, and there are all sorts of wonderful treasures that are layered and layered and layered deep down into these pictures. and sculptures that make them extremely sophisticated and joyful, and you know, that really caused them to endure, which after all is the real criteria for great art, its ability to endure. And that enduring factor, I think, comes out in the fact that work such as you see with Carl Bruss Van Kempen's is very layered and rich, and not merely something on the surface, though accessible immediately on the surface. It's much deeper and richer, and perhaps Carl could maybe talk a little bit about that in his work and perhaps in others.
Yeah, I think that wildlife art in general gets a really bad rap, and a really well-deserved bad rap among the art ninny crowd, because there is a lot of it that's just really bad stuff, really bad art. And most of what you see is, because it's so popular, and you know, a lot of people who make a living painting animals because they can make a living painting animals. You know, if you could make a good living painting, if there were a big demand for paintings of tennis shoes, they'd be painting tennis shoes. Art in the animal really is a pretty good, it's the cream of what's being done. And it's really not the kind of stuff that you see in the genre at large.
Mm-hmm. No kitsch allowed, in fact.
Well, Carl has a piece in the show called Prairie Sentinel.
Yeah.
And it's a really great piece. And there's another artist who has a work in the show of a snake, an eastern diamondback, called
John
Diamondback
Agnew.
In the Rough. John Agnew is his name. He's from Ohio. And each has a really different perspective. But the thing I particularly like about Carl's work is, man, if I were, it's a bison, isn't it, Carl?
Uh-huh.
I mean, that thing, it's a precarious, I'm not sure which animal is in a more precarious position.
Absolutely. That's immediately what I thought when I saw the piece as well. Who's attacking whom here?
Well, I like to deal with evolution and adaptations and what makes animals do the things they do and what gives them the form they have and how they make their living. And it seems like rattlesnakes originally evolved. The oldest fossil rattlesnakes come from the Midwest, and I imagine they probably evolved that rattle exactly for that reason, to keep from being stepped on by bison.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the inspiration for that piece.
What else is going on in that picture? Just for my own interest, I'm interested to hear you talk about it.
Well, there's a bison calf that's on the opposite side of its mother from the snake, and it's basically shows a rattlesnake that's had a herd of bison come upon it, and it's just starting to rattle and warn away the bison.
Mm-hmm. I have to tell you, I'm looking, if you don't mind me saying so, Lisa, on air, I'm sitting here in my office looking out over a snow-covered hardwood forest and floor, and in the maple tree in front of my house at my feeder is a gigantic pileated woodpecker pecking away at some suet, and in the background is a sort of a herd of grazing white-tailed deer. It's a really pretty sight, all sort of with pine trees and birch trees and hardwood forest here. So that's the picture I want to paint for you from where I stand right now.
Sounds pretty idyllic.
I wish Carl were here. He could really make a good picture of it, painting of it.
Carl, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got started as an artist and in fact an animal artist?
Well, I guess most of us start out as animal artists.
Okay.
Some of us grow up, though. and I've always been interested in drawing animals. When I was probably 6 or 7 years old, I was really inspired by Audubon, and I wanted to be another Audubon. And I would go out in the field with my binoculars and sketchbooks and sketch birds, and pretty soon I found out that they would fly away, and you had to be really fast. I've still got stacks of sketchbooks that are full of quarter of the way drawn birds, and I've just kept doing that. And you know, when I look back on the drawings I did when I was 7, 8 years old, I really have been dealing with the same sort of themes, only I think probably more successfully now than I was then.
Could you talk a little bit about maybe the science behind your art? I mean, drawing. I mean, did you have to take a lot of anatomy lessons? Are you an active, watcher of wildlife? Do you watch them move? Do you study them up close?
Yeah, you have to.
Them?
And drawing in the field is really a good discipline. None of my, I do a lot of drawing in the field, but no one ever sees my drawings. They're just for, a very good discipline, and the vast majority of what I do is really not very attractive, but it helps me a lot, and it forces you to really analyze what's going on with their movements. I'm self-taught as an artist. I did take a really good drawing class in high school here in Salt Lake, where they taught perspective and all the fundamentals, which was very helpful, but as far as the rest of it, it was just trial and error, pretty
right,
much.
Right, and
I studied biology in college.
Okay, okay. And you have a the show as a whole seems to have a wide variance of styles, David. Did that make it tough to curate?
Not really, and I should clarify that this is a juried show, so in the sense of a curator selecting pieces for an exhibition, I didn't curate the show, but I did draw from the annual exhibition, which is comprised of perhaps 150 works, to narrow that down to about half that number yet again. In that sense, I sort of was selective in the process. I'd say the thing, though, Lisa, that is really the criteria for me isn't the diversity, because we're looking for diversity. All too often in the past, animal artists have mostly dealt with real glamour species. You know, in the 60s, for example, you'd see the bald eagle or the white-tailed deer, or, you know, real sort of traditional sort of what I would call glamour species. But or it, maybe when Dances with Wolves, the movie came out, everyone was painting wolves. You know, there'd be kind of trendy subject matter that come along. But now the diversity is really that's a good thing, and it's something that doesn't make it difficult. It makes it just a joy to be able to select from really paintings of species and kinds of animals that might not formerly have been portrayed. The other thing in terms of criteria that I look for in selecting works from the tour is of course quality. And by that, I'm talking about how the artist handles his or her media, you know, composition and design, the conceptualization, the richness of that, and just pulling all those things together to develop their own personal style and generally produce a quality work of art. If there is anything that's difficult, Lisa, in terms of judging art and selecting it for exhibitions or whatever, it's that, something that is difficult is when you get to that maybe top 1% or maybe top 3% of all the work that's produced and submitted to exhibitions by living artists, then that is difficult, because quality, you sort of hit a level playing field when you get to that top 2 or 3% of the art world up there, and then it's not so much judging piece against piece for quality. Then it gets to kind of personal taste and preference and things like that. But that's what I found anyway. Maybe the bottom 97% falls off pretty quickly, but that you get to that top criteria, that top echelon of professional artists, and man, there's some really really great work. And you know, you just can't say one picture or one sculpture is better than one another. It's just really different.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Nature of Things on KRCL 90.9 FM, your community radio station. We're talking with exhibit curator Dr. David Wagner and artist Carl Bress Van Kampen about the new temporary exhibition at the Utah Museum of Natural History, Art and the Animal, on display until April the 6th.
Carl, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about process. I know that I've heard for sculptors, and it might be the same for painters, soapstone sculptors in particular, they sort of, it's like the medium talks to them. There's a spirit in the stone. I don't know if that's necessarily true for all artists, but what I'm wondering is, do you have a picture in your head of what you want it to look like, or are you always surprised at the end of what it actually looks like?
I try not to be surprised, but I usually am a little bit. We all have very different processes, different artists. Some artists that are in the show, like John Siri Lester, who has a great... John's hippo piece is in the show, isn't it, David?
That is a fantastic piece. I'm just going to kind of describe it because it's one of the ones that really struck me. I mean, at first you just kind of see this murky water, and then the light comes in at the top and you see the reflection of this hippo head and two kind of searing hippo eyes looking at you. It's a really great piece.
Green water.
Or green water, yeah. Green, murky water.
It's very subtle. And he, I actually, He and Lynn St. Clair, who has a painting of horses crossing a river, both of them are very good friends of mine, and I've painted with both of them a lot. I actually watched both of them paint those paintings. Both of them work in a very similar way. They just start out with a blank canvas, no preliminary drawings, and they just have an idea, and they just start putting paint on. I cannot do that. I have to plan everything. I do a lot of, I start out with an idea. I do a lot of preliminary drawings, start out doing a lot of little sketches, trying to figure out how to make the composition work and how to position the animals. And then I do a more refined drawing. And then I get together reference materials to correct the anatomy and correct the structure and everything. And I wind up with a very complete preliminary drawing that looks just like the painting's going to look. And I usually do value studies. Then I blow up that drawing and then trace it onto my illustration board, cut the size of the illustration board I want, and then I paint on top of that. I paint a detailed underpainting that's all brown, where I just am dealing with textures. Then I tint the board, and then I paint on top of that. So it's a very long, takes me about a month and a half to do a painting like the
Will
bison
you be giving your slide lecture, Carl, that shows the steps you go through at the museum?
Yeah, on March 1st, I'll give a demonstration and talk where I'll be going in depth as to exactly how I do what I do.
Carl and John Siri Lester and I conducted a symposia or seminar at Lawrence University, not far from where I'm based here in the Upper Great Lakes area, and I had the chance to see this program that Carl gave, in fact, several of them, and it's just fantastic. For any listener interested in learning about how an artist works and the steps they go through, I would just highly recommend this program. It's outstanding, and I as a historian, learned many, many new things that I had not previously known.
That's great, and if our listeners out there want to know more information about how to attend this workshop, you can log on to the museum's website at www.umnh.utah.edu. These guys have done all my press for me, which is great. And we're also very fortunate to have David Wagner come, and he is going to do a lecture for us on February the 28th about the history of wildlife art. David, do you want to give us a bit of a teaser about your lecture?
Well, I was always interested to know in my own research, writing, lecturing, and my work in general, how this genre of art came to be, how we have the Carl Bress Van Kempens of the world today, John Siri Lester, Robert Bateman, Roger Torrey Peterson, and all the great artists of our time. So as a historian, I went back in time and studied and learned all I could about the earliest artists, the predecessors to today's artists like John James Audubon, who's probably as well known as anyone, and actually who went before Audubon and who came after him. So my slide presentation, my slide lecture, is sort of a walk through the story of wildlife artists and how they discovered the North American continent and its flora and fauna and portrayed it in their many different styles and beauty. So that's really the nature of my talk, Lisa.
I guess you could sort of say that animal art has been with us since, cave drawings, really. I mean, that kind of reflects that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about how animal art has evolved as a genre?
Well, early on, at least in America, the North American continent, the earliest work being done that relates to the work that's in art and the animal was produced by artists who accompanied expeditions from England and France to the North American continent. I'm talking about artists like John White, who was sent by Sir Walter Raleigh on an expedition, a reconnaissance expedition, to find out about the New World and bring back pictures and images of the people they found in the North American continent and the flora and fauna, the animals and the plants. And, in fact, Raleigh's idea was to use that imagery to lure investors to fund the planting of a colony on the eastern seaboard and exploit natural resources in this you know, previously undiscovered, at least by European standards, undiscovered continent. And these were wonderful watercolor drawings that John White rendered, and in fact have a rich and interesting story of themselves. You might think of his work in terms of its imagery as being sort of outlined and then colored in with very subtle watercolor to give colors. That kind of imagery, that kind of didactic or teaching kind of imagery, prevailed pretty much throughout the Age of Enlightenment, but made a transition in the 19th century when Romanticism, the great Romantic movement, sort of impacted wildlife art, and art in the middle of the 19th century, in terms of animal art, became more painterly, where broader brush strokes were part of the picture. And I'm thinking perhaps of an artist like, Arthur Tate, or later maybe Carl Rungius, the great German artist who came to America and brought sort of an impressionistic style to the genre, changed it all together and gave it a whole new kind of dimension. The story and the evolution of wildlife art is really, really interesting and sort of shaped the larger art world, but it was shaped, of course, by forces around it, too. So the kind of work that you see in today's artists like Carl Bruce Van Kempen or other artists obviously grew out of this long tradition and carries it on and will shape a vision of artists into the future.
Carl, I'm going to ask you a personal question. Two personal questions, I guess. Where do you get your inspiration from? And secondly, who are some of your favorite animal artists that you admire and possibly inspire you as well?
Okay, the inspiration is the easy part. I'm inspired by nature. I'm fascinated by nature, and there's a limitless supply of ideas. A lot of wildlife artists, I was talking about John Searle Lester earlier. John is very much like this. John will not paint anything that he is an animal that he hasn't seen in a while. So he'll travel long distances if he wants to paint something. Like he wanted to paint pandas and went on this great expedition to China and spent a lot of time trying to see pandas and painting them in the wild. And he won't paint anything that he hasn't seen in the wild. And a lot of wildlife artists are like that. They paint stuff that they've seen and as a way of sharing their experiences with humanity. Mm-hmm. Myself, I'm more selfish. I paint a lot of stuff that I tend to paint stuff that I would like to see as a way of seeing it. I paint more for myself than for other people. And most of my paintings are exactly that. It's something that I think it would be cool to see, so I'll set up a situation and paint it. And in the time it takes me to paint a painting, I generally come up with like 6 or 7 ideas for new ones. So it's the inspiration that compels me to paint rather than the other way around. And as far as other artists, my favorite artist, I think my very favorite artist in the genre painting animals is Ray Harris Ching. He's he lives in New Zealand or Australia now?
New Zealand.
New Zealand. He's moved from New Zealand to Australia to England and back and forth all his life, and I can't keep track of where he is. But he's an amazing artist. Carl Brenders, who's a member of the Society of Animal Artists, he's a Belgian artist, and no one has ever been able to paint the textures of nature in detail and with the richness that he does. He's just a magician, and he's been very good to me and has taught me a lot. My painting wouldn't be nearly as good if I had never met him. He's been a huge inspiration to me and a huge teacher to me. And as far as my formative artists, probably Salvador Dali, Audubon, and Rembrandt. Those three artists, as a kid, I was fascinated with their work, and I copied their work a lot. And they're the ones that really taught me how to draw and paint just by copying their work and really scrutinizing what they did.
Wow, quite a range of styles there.
yeah. I think you can see all of those artists in my work.
Wow, neat.
I think that's true, and Carl's work is certainly different than any other artist's work that I know of. I don't know of another artist who paints or conceptualizes work quite like you do, and I find it really interesting and provocative. And I should mention, Lisa, because of that, I had proposed that an exhibition, a one-man show, be given to Carl's work. And in fact, my proposal was approved, and he will be having a one-man show at a major museum in Denver next year that I get to curate. So I'm really lucky to know Carl and work with him, and I'm hoping that if there's any possibility, we can also bring the exhibition from its premiere in Denver to Salt Lake and let people there enjoy Carl's entire body of work and see his work in all of its variety and numbers.
Yeah, and for those of you that don't know, Carl, you're a native of Salt Lake. You live here, right?
Yep, grew up in Immigration Canyon.
Whoa, nice. So
it was a great place to grow up. And that had a lot to do, too, that growing up there had a lot to do with making me the artist that I am.
Well, that is wonderful. So if you're a fan of wildlife art, there are actually three fabulous temporary exhibits going on. The one that we've been talking about primarily has been Art and the Animal at the Utah Museum of Natural History. There's also one at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts called Menagerie, Animals in Art, and at the Hogle Zoo as well. And Carl, you have a piece at the Hogle Zoo, yes?
I have a piece at the Hogle Zoo, too. Yeah.
An award-winning piece. Don't miss these wonderful shows. They're really great. I'd like to thank both of you for joining me in an interview today.
Thank you, Lisa.
You bet. I look forward to visiting.
We look forward to seeing you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you're interested in learning more about wildlife art, join us for a public lecture and art demonstration by David Wagner and Carl Bress Van Kampen on Friday, February the 28th at the Utah Museum of Natural History, starting at 7 p.m. Call 585-3948 or log on to our website at www.umnh.utah.edu for more information. The exhibit Art and the Animal will be on display at the Utah Museum of Natural History until April the 5th. This has been The Nature of Things. I'm your host, Lisa Hurl. Thank you for listening.